Hello, this is Brian Schaefer, professor of English at Rhodes College. It would be difficult to overestimate James Joyce's importance to 20th century Irish and indeed world literature. A recent Modern Library's critics poll of the top 100 novels of the 20th century found Joyce's works to be among the very greatest and most influential of the period. Specifically, the poll deemed Joyce's Ulysses to be the greatest English language novel, while the author's autobiographical A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man came in third place, and his Finnegan's Wake ranked 77th. More than a century and a quarter after his birth in 1882, Joyce remains a cult figure for many, and there is no sign that interest in his fiction is letting up. Indeed, I would argue that even now, more than six decades after his death in 1941, we have yet to fully understand this innovative, iconoclastic voice in modern fiction. As Joyce's greatest biographer, Richard Ellman, comments, "We are still learning to be James Joyce's contemporaries, to understand our interpreter." Joyce spent the vast majority of his adulthood in Trieste, Paris, and Zurich, yet he wrote only about Dublin and set all of his fictions in Dublin, the Irish metropolis and capital city. He maintained what might best be described as a love-hate relationship with the city of his origin, which he left, pretty much for good, in 1904 at age 22. Similarly, he maintained a love-hate relationship with the church of his origin, the Roman Catholic Church, which he formally rejected in 1898 at age 16. Joyce explained, "I found it impossible to remain in it on account of the impulses of my nature." A clue as to what he means here can be found in his novel, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, when the protagonist, Stephen Dedalus, a thinly disguised adolescent Joyce, concludes that his destiny was to be elusive of social or religious orders. He was destined to learn his own wisdom apart from others. As the Irish novelist Edna O'Brien observes, Joyce broke with the Catholic Church while he was still in his teens, but in another sense, he never left it. He couldn't. The indoctrination from mother and priests had been too intense. On both mothers, he would wage open and unrepentant war, calling the Catholic Church the scullery maid of Christendom. The sermons of the priests filled him with terror and then repugnance. Regardless, religious motifs would permeate all of Joyce's works. Joyce also supplies a clue as to why he chose self-exile rather than remain in Ireland. "No one who has any self-respect stays in Ireland," he wrote in an early essay, "but flees afar as though from a country that has undergone the visitation of an angered Jove." He also provides a clue concerning his reason for fleeing Ireland in his autobiographical portrait. "When the soul of man is born in this country," Stephen at one point lectures his peers, "there are nets flung at it to hold it back from flight. You talk to me of nationality, language, religion. I shall try to fly by those nets." Fly by those nets, Joyce did, and he didn't fly alone. With him went his lifelong companion and soulmate, Nora Barnacle. Nora and Joyce eventually had two children together, but only married after decades of cohabitation. Joyce was every bit the rebel with respect to matrimonial ties that he was with respect to religious and literary conventions. Joyce wrote poetry and drama. Indeed, his great early influence was the Norwegian playwright Ibsen, but it is his highly innovative works of prose fiction that have assured him immortality. His four major works of fiction are Dubliners, a collection of 15 stories that concludes with the dead; A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, a somewhat earnest coming-of-age novel that traces the arc of Joyce's childhood; Ulysses, a modernist masterpiece of 700 pages that is set in one day, that loosely follows Homer's Odyssey, hence its title, that plumbs the depths and shallows of character psychology via stream-of-consciousness narration as no work before it or since; and Finnegan's Wake, a fiction made up of idiosyncratic language and multilingual puns so radical and so difficult to read that the work may be said to explode the novel form entirely. This, Joyce's final work, took the author 17 years to write and was designed to keep scholars busy for decades, trying to untangle its seemingly infinite nuances and meanings. 70 years on, they're still at it. To return to a consideration of Dubliners, the 15 stories in the collection were penned between 1904 and 1907, when Joyce was 22 to 25 years of age. They are astoundingly mature and accomplished fictions for such a young writer. Although only 379 copies of the book were sold in the first year of its publication, Dubliners is today regarded as nothing less than a masterpiece, one of the unquestionably great story collections or story cycles in any language. Joyce's ambitions and target audience for Dubliners couldn't have been more clearly articulated by the author. He sought to hold the mirror up to the Irish people and depict their intellectual, spiritual, political, and socioeconomic paralysis in a style of scrupulous meanness. "My intention," Joyce declared in a letter, "was to write a chapter of the moral history of my country, and I chose Dublin for the scene because that city seemed to me the center of paralysis." Indeed, paralysis is the central metaphor of the collection. The volume even opens with a boy narrator contemplating a paralyzed priest, a stroke victim, who we soon learn has died. The Irish needed strong medicine to cure their malaise, according to Joyce, and Dubliners was precisely the bitter pill that would do them a world of good. "I seriously believe that you will retard the course of civilization," the author commented with characteristic boastfulness, "by preventing the Irish people from having one good look at themselves in my nicely polished looking glass. I believe that in composing my chapter of moral history, in exactly the way I've composed it, I have taken the first step towards the spiritual liberation of my country." Those who read exclusively for plot will find precious little of interest in Joyce's Dubliners. But those who prize the ability of fiction to imagine a world, to penetrate and explore a psychological and physical reality at once recognizable and strange, and to make sublime music of everyday language, will find much of interest here. The 15 stories, all of which focus on quotidian encounters between commonplace Dubliners, are best read collectively rather than in isolation, in that the meanings accrue and reverberate throughout the collection. The stories are also best read repeatedly rather than once. As Joseph Frank notes, "Joyce cannot be read, he can only be reread. Knowledge of the whole is essential to an understanding of any part." The first 14 stories in the collection are wry and at points caustic depictions of Dublin life. They take aim at Joyce's compatriots, in particular at their self-destructive idealizations of the Irish family, state, religion, school, and pub, in ways that are as subtle as they are, paradoxically, devastating. The Dead, the final and perhaps greatest of the volume's stories, represents a changing of gears. Here Joyce's presentation of his characters is more magnanimous and sympathetic, less vitriolic and wry. Here he seems to abandon the aim of being cruel to be kind. A cosmic vision, replete with supernatural echoes, replaces the grindingly realistic, scrupulously mean vision of the collection's earlier stories. The plot of The Dead, which derives from Joycean autobiography as well as from George Moore's now-forgotten 1891 novel Vain Fortune, is easily told. It's structured around protagonist Gabriel Conroy's three awkward encounters with females during one night in early January of 1904. It opens with Gabriel and Greta Conroy, a middle-class, middle-aged married couple, arriving at the annual holiday party of Gabriel's music teacher aunts Kate and Julia Morkin and their niece Mary Jane Morkin. Other guests include Molly Ivers, an Irish patriot, Mr. Brown, who stands out for being a Protestant in this largely Catholic gathering and city, Freddie Mallins, an alcoholic who has made a New Year's resolution to give up drink, but even now, in the first week of the year, seems to have fallen off the wagon, and Bartell Darcy, a noted tenor. Lily, the Morkin sisters' domestic servant, is on hand to serve. Gabriel's first awkward encounter upon his arrival at the Morkins is with Lily, who is tasked with helping the gentlemen remove and stow their overcoats in the pantry. Although he intends merely to be friendly with her, Gabriel proceeds to put his foot in his mouth by asking Lily whether, having now reached adulthood, she is soon to be married. "The man that is now," Lily answers Gabriel bitterly and ungrammatically, "is only all palaver, talk, and what they can get out of you. Presumably something of a carnal nature." Gabriel's subsequent offer to Lily of a Christmastime tip does little to relieve his feelings of guilt for uttering the ill-received comment. The evening proceeds with dancing, singing, and feasting, but front and center in Gabriel's mind is the after-dinner speech which, as every year, he will be called upon to deliver. Being better educated than the others, he is clearly concerned that his speech will miss its target and be above the head of his hearers. Gabriel's alternating feelings of superiority and inferiority, he would fail with his hearers, he worries, just as he failed with the girl in the pantry, dog him all night. Gabriel decides on a safe course for his speech, which, though generous in its celebration of the Morkan sisters' hospitality, is also arguably cliché-ridden, derivative, and sentimental. Before dinner and the after-dinner speech, however, Gabriel has a second awkward encounter with a female, this time with Molly Ivers, who accuses Gabriel of being a West Briton, an Irishman with British Unionist sympathies. Remember, Ireland in Joyce's time was not independent, but a part of the British Empire. Molly's evidence for this charge is that Gabriel writes book reviews for the Daily Express, a newspaper with Unionist sympathies. Gabriel, in contrast to this Irish nationalist, conceives of literature as above politics and is annoyed by Molly's exhortations that he and Greta take their summer vacation in the west of Ireland rather than, as is his plan, in Europe. "Haven't you your own land to visit?" she asks him. Hours later, in the waning moments of the party, the tenor Bartell D'Arcy is heard singing The Lass of Aughrim, a ballad that treats the seduction and abandonment of a peasant maid, now pregnant by a lord. We eventually learn that this song prompts Greta's recollection of a childhood suitor, Michael Fury, who used to sing the same song and who died tragically early in life. Greta and Michael at this time live not in Dublin, but in the west of Ireland. Following the Morkan party, rather than returning to their kids and home some miles away, Gabriel and Greta check into a posh hotel in central Dublin, the Gresham. This hotel still exists today. Joyce shows us that Gabriel views this romantic getaway with Greta as a sort of second honeymoon for the two. Gabriel clearly anticipates something both romantic and sexual transpiring in the hotel room. But Greta, moved by her recollection of Michael Fury, that is rekindled by hearing The Lass of Aughrim, is not on the same page as her husband. Greta is torn up with memories of her long-dead childhood boyfriend, Michael Fury, for whom she felt, as he clearly felt for her, pangs of adolescent love that would not be out of place in Romeo and Juliet. "I think he died for me," Greta says of him. After unburdening herself of her grief, Greta proceeds to fall asleep, the worst possible conclusion to the evening for Gabriel, who envisioned the two instead re-experiencing their earlier moments of ecstasy together, and Greta reaffirming her love for him. This hotel room scene constitutes Gabriel's third awkward encounter with a female that evening. In the competition for his wife's affection, he is bested by a dead man, whose form Gabriel now drowsily conjures in his imagination. What follows is the justly famous epiphanic closing of the story, in which Gabriel, after his wife drifts off to sleep, falls asleep himself to the accompaniment of his own musings on life and death and the falling snow which, according to the weather forecast, will blanket Ireland this night. At the same time, Gabriel undergoes a figurative dying, a voyage to the land of the dead. Or is it rather the dead and gone who are, in his musings, making their presence felt in the land of the living? The air of the room chilled his shoulders. He stretched himself cautiously along under the sheets and lay down beside his wife. One by one, they were all becoming shades. Better pass boldly into that other world, in the full glory of some passion, than fade and wither dismally with age. His own identity was fading out into a gray, impalpable world. The solid world itself, which those dead had one time reared and lived in, was dissolving and dwindling. In the most lyrical and poignant, though at no point sentimental or maudlin, prose imaginable, Joyce, in the story's closing passages, figures the interfusing of death and life, past and present, self and other, inside and outside, black and white, everything now is gray, long-dead lover and living husband, West Coast and East Coast of Ireland. Greta's recent flood of tears, coupled with the recollected tears of the ailing Michael Fury of long ago, now prompt Gabriel's own tears, which gather thickly in his eyes, mirroring the falling snow which lies thickly drifted across the land. Everything in this poetically intense, sublimely resonant final scene is figured as drifting, falling, or swooning. The falling snow, Gabriel's tears, his falling asleep and figurative death. Even Joyce's language here seems to drift down, gently and obliquely, earthward from above. This sketch of the dead, inadequate though it is, at least explains one obvious interpretive enigma of the tale. Why this story, so ostensibly full of life, is called The Dead. The story may be set during the holidays and may depict an intoxicating party replete with food, drink, song, and dance, a sensual feast for the eye, ear, and taste buds. Yet it also poignantly shows the dead and the living, and the past and the present, which usually are seen as divided by a hard and fast boundary, to be interanimating and interpenetrating forces, ones divided by the most porous and vanishing of boundaries. Joyce reveals, in Gabriel's epiphany, a vision of death and life as commingling, as equally blanketed by snow, as a closed circle, just as the story as a whole gestures towards circularity, its title and its final two words, the dead, being one and the same. The Dead was adapted for the screen by John Huston in 1987. It was also adapted for the Broadway stage in 1999. Now it's been adapted once more, this time for radio, by Bob Arnold and Chatterbox Theater. In an ingenious twist, this superb treatment for the airwaves transplants Joyce's turn of the last century Dublin setting to Memphis, in a southern U.S. retelling of The Dead. Far be it for me to speak for James Joyce, but I'm certain that he would have been flattered by the idea and pleased with the result of Dead and Gone.